Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 347.
This week on the podcast, the Biden Endorse Fest attendees are wondering why the left won't come along for the ride.
And a new stimulus is possible. But will it actually stimulate anybody?
Plus, more people are newly unemployed than have voted in the Democratic primary so far.
Plus, turns out stay-at-home orders actually work.
And that's why Trump hates them.
Plus, there's a Michael Cohen tell-all coming to you from his house, where he currently is. Just like you.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
Yes.
Get ready for an episode that might accidentally include me ranting off the rails.
Oh, you've already lost it.
Untold amounts of time. Brent sort of unfortunately kept texting me the news this week, as he does every week, which is normally something we have an ongoing conversation happening about.
Right.
And poor Brent texted me on Monday to let me know about some new Biden endorsements. And then texted me on Tuesday to let me know about the Obama endorsement. Or, you know, maybe Tuesday or Wednesday. I can't remember what it was. In any case, all he got was like an angry screed back every single time. So Brent and I are in different places in our mourning processes right now. And that's maybe something you should know going into this episode.
Yeah. And you know what? That's fine.
That's right.
We're okay with that.
Yeah. It's actually, I think, a good indication of what's happening to the left right now. Like, we're sort of on two extremes of what's happening to the left.
I think that it is. It was funny. We also have, I mean, you and I have sort of a fairly, you know, ongoing text chain, as you might expect. We also have one with Grant.
Friend of the podcast.
You know, yes, who's hosted with us a few times. And he texted something about, I don't even remember, but it was in regards to what you're going to have a rant
something
about.
Something totally unknowingly, innocuous, though.
Because, like, he had not been privy to your rant that, you know, you had put in my direction earlier in the week. And I was like, Grant, no. You can't. Right. Stop. Stop everything. Can't do it.
I did declare, I think I said to Brent maybe on Wednesday, something as dramatic as, and coming from me, this is quite dramatic. This wouldn't be that dramatic coming from Joe Schmo, but coming from someone who has literally decided to sit down once a week and do a deep dive into the news and host a podcast about this. I said to Brent, I get it. I get why people don't vote.
I know. Well, you remember, though, because, you know, I didn't say this to you specifically at the time, but when we were talking about, when, you know, you were like, you're at a different place than I am. I was apoplectic.
Right.
A couple weeks ago, maybe about a month or so
ago.
I mean, yeah. It was really sort of like the podcast that we recorded the day after the South Carolina. I mean, I had already, within that 24 hours, changed my party affiliation, you know, on my voter registration, requested a new voter card, and paid my dues to the DSA.
Yeah. Right. So. Brent went through this entire cycle about a month ago, and I'll tell you what happened on Monday.
Right.
I had already left the Democratic Party, as you might not be surprised to hear if you listen regularly. But I woke up on Monday to an email from my mother asking if I wanted a gift membership to DSA. And then
I said yes, and
then within 15 minutes I had one.
Right.
She was like sitting at her computer waiting for me to want to get a membership to DSA.
Yeah.
So we're all Democratic Socialists now. That's great news. Mm-hmm. It did make me feel a little better.
It does,
made me feel like I had fought the power a little bit. We're going to start with some things Biden did well this week, but then I'm going to discuss some of the missteps that both him and I think the sort of larger DNC are making right now that are explaining why. I mean, like, if you are somebody who knows any people who are political in your life, you are dealing with the frustration of a bunch of whiny Sanders people who, like, don't want to come along for the ride and are furious at Sanders for endorsing and are furious about everything and are not sure what's happening. Don't understand why they, as if they can't see that Donald Trump is evil. And so I'm going to explain what I see those missteps as being and why this reaction is happening and why, I mean, I'm having this reaction almost against my will. Like, I am, like, unable to have, like, a conversation about Joe Biden right now. That is not something I wish for myself.
Right.
That is just something that happened this week.
Yeah.
So this week, Sanders, Warren, and Obama all endorsed Joe Biden.
Yeah.
Sanders and Biden did, like, a sort of town hall live stream together.
They did.
At which, and that was the beginning of me and Brent's conversation, because Brent asked if I was watching it, and I had turned it on for about 5 minutes and literally burst into tears and had to turn it off. So I started the week not in a good place, and I've also ended it there. But I had the same problem.
Week. You know, it's like week five or week six. You know, I mean, there's going to be some good ones. There's going to be some bad ones.
Right. I've been sitting in my home this whole time, hopeless about the pandemic situation. And that's all I needed was more hopelessness. And then Obama released a video and Brent was like, innocently enough, the next day, did you see the Obama video? And I said,
right. That I should have known not to text you on that one. But I was like, well, you know, maybe that's going to be more palatable for her. I don't know.
I did watch part of the Obama video. And when I found myself screaming fuck you at the TV, I knew I should turn it off, and I wasn't in the healthiest space to be watching the Obama video. The only thing that I was able to read all the way through, not watch all the way through, was I did read the letter that Biden sent to the Warren mailing list all the way through. Everything else I've watched clips of, I've read about them, I have
interesting.
Done.
Interesting, I have not read that.
But I read that whole letter, and I'll tell you why I read the letter, and I think it is the one thing he's done right here. Is the letter begins with, I want to earn your vote. And that's the first sentence of it. That tone, which was notably not present with the Sanders people in my sort of scattered experience with it, is, I think, the tone that Clinton failed to achieve when she attempted this exact process. Months later, that's part of my later notes on this process.
Sure.
But when she attempted this process, there was never any sort of sense that she intended to earn the votes on the left. She just wanted us to deal with it.
Right.
And so I did appreciate that someone had advised that campaign to approach those. I can see, you know, I'm a Sanders person. I consider myself also a Warren person. I feel like I am sort of part of both camps to some degree. And I feel like that was the right tone to approach the Warren voters with.
Yeah.
So I think he's at least got that sort of a little bit better figured out. And then there was some similar talk when he had his conversation with Sanders, but I will let Brent discuss what his promises were to the Sanders coalition, since I rage turned it off and then only read scattered things about it later.
Yeah. I mean, I just felt like, to your point about the, you know, sort of like where we got in 2016 was sort of, you know, the way that Clinton spoke to us. I guess that, and look, I think that we have to, I'm not just going to be like, look, I'm Team Biden now all of a sudden. Because to your point, you know, we talked a little bit about this last week, that Sanders voters are policy voters. Yeah. Which I think is what made what Biden is doing smart. Because the thing that he is doing is the two campaigns are going to have, there's like six issues that they're going to discuss, and they're going to have like working policy discussions about to figure out to figure out what they can come up with and maybe work together on and find some common ground on. So I think that was smart specifically for the Sanders people, because like that is sort of, that's what they're voting on. Now, it could all be hogwash. Like, which I think is what your point was, because you're like, I feel like every so often, whether it's a presidential year or whether it's whatever it is, if there's something going on in the country or whatever, you know, we sort of, you know, we get thrown a bone every once in a while, sort of, you know, we get the scraps, and it's like, and it's just sort of to keep us in, you know, it's like just like one sort of like little scrap to sort of like make it seem like they care about what we're fighting for. And so I get that, because it's like, we've lived it, you know?
Yeah.
But I guess I don't even know if excitement is the right word, but sort of like the reason that I felt sort of, that I reacted positively to it was because... was because that I felt like it was so far and fast too. I mean, it was like a quick acknowledgement that the Sanders coalition was important. He talked a lot about young people and what they care about and how he's going to work for their votes. And look, he's never going to move as far to the left as Sanders, at least certainly not now, because he's just not going to. So like, we're not going to get everything out of him that we want to. But I got the sense, at least more than probably I ever have truly in my entire life, that
with people like what we've been dealing with.
Well, right.
Not
that's
hard.
What I'm saying. Like with the, you know, with the party establishment that there was the first time that they were acknowledging that not only were we important, but that we also might be right on some stuff. And I think both Biden and Obama addressed it specifically sort of like in because of sort of the times that we're in right now. I mean, I think Obama really sort of set up some potential new thinking for the party, or at least the party establishment anyway, just because of the way that we need to move forward here. And it's like, I don't know, all of these things are different than I feel like we have ever been given, certainly in 2016, which, well, I mean, we just were like immediately written off and then were, you know, made to feel bad that it was like somehow our fault that like we didn't, you know, all go out in droves to elect the woman.
The sort of thing that they're pushing against here is the feeling on the left that we have, like, you don't get to win on the left. We're going to be blamed if he loses. We're going to lose if he wins. Like, it's so they really don't acknowledge that they're setting us up for a lose-lose situation where one loss is just like really dramatic and the other loss is just like our future. Like, one loss is very present and one loss is a future, but either way we lose and then we get blamed for our own loss at the end of it, which I think is not something they've ever fully like acknowledged that they did to us in 2016.
Totally.
I feel like my opposite reaction to the task force announcement was actually sort of, I think, based on the same understanding I have about voters on the left, which is that they're policy voters. And my feeling was just task forces are not a policy promise. They're a promise to discuss. It's like when we used to joke about the U.S. setting meetings to discuss when our next meeting would be. A task force is a promise to discuss when your next meeting about about the issue is going to be. It's really a promise to change your thinking on anything.
No, it's not.
And I think that when you're asking to earn someone's vote, you know, he's had a lot of time to find out what the left wants because Bernie Sanders has run with sizable minorities of the party for a long time at this point. You know, now this is his second cycle. So it's not that he doesn't know what we want. He doesn't need to hear, you know, if he doesn't yet know why the left wants, you know, a Green New Deal or wants single-payer healthcare, he just hasn't been listening. The information is out there. A task force kicks the can. It doesn't offer any actual meaningful concessions to the left. And so it's like when we used to say, you know, earlier in the cycle, we were really impressed with Marianne Williamson for one thing, which is she at least tried to throw a random number at the reparations question. She was the only person who didn't say, let's discuss it and then leave it at that.
Right.
And that is a meaningful difference, especially when we're talking about an issue that is so sort of, or a series of issues that are so sort of clearly and directly impacting people's lives in the present as they sit at home with no ability to work, with no, you know, ability to afford healthcare, with, you know, with a very scary pandemic on their hands. Like, these are not issues that he should need to be educated on. What he should have is an idea about where he can find common ground with us already. And so this made it seem like they were setting us up to tell us they couldn't find common ground anywhere that we would consider common.
Sure. I agree with that. And I think we have to see what policy changes come, if any, and we have to see like what these task forces, you know, what comes out of them.
Yeah.
And it could be nothing. And that would be bad. I mean, I agree with you, but
I just think they've never given us a reason to trust that it won't be, because at no time have they ever participated in good faith in this kind of a process.
I totally agree. I just think that the sense that I got, and this could be complete delusion on my part, and I'll own it later because I always do. But
walking around in a rage for no reason. We're all going to have to own our feelings.
I know. But what I would say, and this is what I feel like I'm getting from that I got from Biden himself, that I certainly got from Obama for sure, is that the times that we're in right now are giving them cover to actually change.
And
who knows whether they actually will. But I think that they are at least thinking that to themselves, is now maybe the time to realize and use it as our excuse. It gives them an excuse. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of it's like something, it's almost like it's the thing that they've needed to actually sort of like come around on some of these things. Because like, look, I mean, you know, you were talking about this earlier, whether it's actually Joe Biden's goal for everybody to have health insurance or what.
And I have something to say about this too when you're done.
I know, we're going to get to that in a second. But like on some level, now is a perfect time for everybody to be like, oh, well, we at least at minimum have to, you know, offer free health insurance to like everybody who's lost a job, because like, how can we expect people who have like had their health insurance tied to their employment, like expect to be able to pay for health insurance? Like you have, like we're living in the world where it makes sense to do that now. Yeah. And it always made sense to do it, but like now you have this, and like short of saying that specifically, I feel like both of these guys, Biden and Obama, both sort of acknowledge that like, we might be there, and they certainly haven't said so yet. And like, who knows what they're going to come up with? Like, I'm with you in the sense that it's like, you have to wait it out and see, because it might be nothing and it will probably be nothing. And that would be,
well, and I think this is an area where the fact that, you know, Obama and Biden are actually distinct entities to me on this one, using healthcare as the example, because Obama is somebody who has, after leaving office, said in public, yeah, our goal should be a single-payer healthcare or a single-payer system. Even Hillary Clinton has admitted that that's a better system. All of these people, after they leave the public eye or leave office, suddenly are like, yeah, that should probably be our goal. We're not going to get there easily, but that should be the goal.
Yeah.
What I was saying to Brent before we started, I sort of had a moment where I was asked to consider what it would take for me to suddenly feel positive about Joe Biden. And I had an answer right away. It was not something where I was like, oh, I don't know, I'm just so angry. I'm angry, but I'm practical too.
Sure.
I said what it would take is Joe Biden admitting that single payer is the goal. Not that he's going to bring it to us. Not that he necessarily, you know, has a plan or a desire to bring it to us. Just that he knows it should be the goal. And here is where I think my problem is he does not actually believe that. And the reason he doesn't believe that is money. It has to do with money. And so I don't think he's as freed up to make these kinds of changes as he should be in this situation. Like, I said a few weeks ago on the podcast, in my ideal world, and this might become my new voting criteria, I don't know, I haven't decided yet. the Democratic Party would decide that it's not worth taking big pharma and the insurance industry's money anymore and would just fucking go with some other evil corporations. You know, there's money pouring in from everywhere. There's money. Everyone wants to get a tax break and favorable, you know, legislation. And just as I think, you know, you can't, it's hard at the moment to take money from oil and gas if you're a Democrat. If you do it, you're on the target list for a lot of progressives. That health insurance money should be the same thing. There's a lot of people who we respect on the left who do not deserve our respect because of their taking big insurance and big pharma money. James Clyburn is one of the biggest big pharma money recipients in Congress right now. But yeah. James Clyburn is why Joe Biden currently is in the position he's in.
I was going to say he made our current candidate right now.
Cory Booker, big pharma money. Yeah. Cory Booker does not get asked about that. He barely gets asked to qualify it. He was a few times hit on it a few times in the presidential cycle because he decided to swear off of it for that. Right. But what I want to hear is that these people are serious about sort of like admitting that the goal exists.
And if that's what's preventing them
from doing it, then that's what they, you know, then the money is what they need to get, you know, to lose. But where I don't feel confident in all of their well-meaning, vague messaging is that they're not actually freed up to admit that their goal is the same as my goal. And at the point that we're working at cross purposes, it's a lot to ask me to suddenly go in whole hog, because I've said many times on this podcast, I don't believe in the public option system. I think that that is a compromise system that leads us to a worse place than a fully private system. I know the fully private system sucks too. Like, I get that all sucks, but—
Well, and it still doesn't even help the— It still wouldn't even help the situation that we're in right now if you're looking at that, because like you're looking at a public option being something that is just competing with healthcare companies, you know,
on the exchange,
and you're still having to pay for it. So it might be a cheaper option, but like if you're someone who has just, you know, lost your job because of a global health crisis and then are still having to pay for your health insurance, you've not solved the problem that we're in right now, which is I go back to sort of like this being the thing that like could maybe make them get there.
Well, and
like I said, like maybe I'm delusional, but like also, I think that they have to acknowledge that like the things that they are offering would not even be fixing the situation that we're in right now.
Well, that's if the case is that this gives them cover to reconsider, I'm all for it. And that's where I remind everyone that unity is a process. And
100%.
I believe very firmly that that process needs to be completed in order to have any sort of meaningful chance of winning an election. So, you know, you can't just sort of like flip a switch and have everyone be like, whoops, we don't like, you know, this person that we hated yesterday is suddenly the person that we love. And you also can't ask people to argue vociferously for somebody who like truly doesn't share their goals. Yep. Because the Sanders rhetoric was all goal oriented. It wasn't about process. It was about goals. Yep. The Warren, the Warren rhetoric was sort of somewhere in between, but none of it was as absent of goals as the Biden platform.
Right.
So I think, you know, unity being a process, it really is incumbent upon the people that do support Biden, the moderate Democrats who are interested in finding a way for the left to come along, to find a way to talk to the left that respects that they are going through a process right now.
Yeah.
And I also, so this is where I think we should get into where I see some missteps being made that are losing voters like me. And like, I think a lot of the time there's this sort of, there's two things that go on. One is that people sort of create a sort of false binary where they tell you that a vote, you know, a vote for not Biden is a vote for Trump. And if you say, oh, I'm not loving Biden, they say, oh, what, you're not going to vote? Like, there's a lot of reactionary stuff that doesn't help you feel good about voting for Biden.
Yeah.
And so I think they should maybe recognize first that vote blue no matter who rhetoric is not going to work on the people that it didn't work on before. Like, right. if the left was who that didn't work on before, because then they would have voted for Biden if that's what they believed. That was his whole platform, was basically a vote blue. I'm the vote blue no matter who guy. Like, if you are wondering, if you are shocked and scandalized that the left is not willing to just sit up and be like, well, vote blue no matter who, then, I mean, stop clutching your pearls, because the left was pretty clear that that rhetoric didn't work on them before. So, of course, it's not going to work on them. And the left is practical. The left knows that we make compromises a lot on the left, a lot. So the implication that we somehow don't understand how to compromise drives me bananas, because we have literally only ever compromised. We have not. And if you're,
I mean, it's a huge portion of our party, and we still go out and vote for every single House candidate that we have to, whether we like them or not. We vote for every single Senate candidate, whether we like to or not. I mean, good Lord, what do you think, that the left didn't vote in the wave of, you know, 40 pickups in the House
had? I think what you're about to hear
we'll get around to it.
You're about to hear also the sound of a lot of people saying the name Jill Stein at you and not acknowledging, and also this sort of bizarre implication that the people who don't show up to vote are just like angry Sanders supporters.
Right.
And the Democrats who don't vote are so much deeper than just lefties. It's apathetic people. And apathetic people are apathetic because of some of the things that I'm about to list right now, which I don't think necessarily makes you a lefty. It just makes you a person who reads the news. So I think the first thing, here are the missteps that I think are being made right now and can be rectified. All of this can be rectified, but I think this is where the people that are sort of working for the Biden coalition need to kind of wrap their mind around what, you know, how to address some of these issues in order to see the left become not just like, not just show up to vote for them, but, you know, as we've said before, there's such a thing as high value voters, and those are voters that turn other voters. And the left has a lot of them. So what you're actually looking for is enthusiasm from the left. You're not just looking for people willing to fucking tolerate it. Because if Brent and I just tolerate voting for Joe Biden, then we haven't asked our list of, you know, 100 or 200 people to vote for him too with any enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And some of those people may anyway, but a lot of them may not. We don't know. And like, that's really the difference. Giving us something to be enthusiastic about is kind of important because of that. But so in any case, I think the first thing they need to address is that this process has been flawed. First of all, Barack Obama should not have been put in a position where he was calling contenders for president and asking them to drop out. If he was going
to
not
in like a 48-hour time period to like get it done, and that be the news going into Super Tuesday,
remember
where all
when
the delegates
it looked
were happening.
Like the DNC was fiddling with the race behind our back in 2016. Well, that is what that looks like.
Right. They did it they didn't do it behind our backs this time.
They did it right in front of our faces.
Right in our faces.
Yeah. And so I've been hearing a lot of messaging that Biden won fair and square, but millions of Democrats haven't had a chance to weigh in. And the sort of perceived inevitability of him winning lowers turnout and lowers enthusiasm, and it's a terrible long game strategy. And I especially am frustrated because it fucks down ballot contenders.
Well, and that's where I sort of like net over, out with it.
And it's great for incumbents, and that's why they did it. They don't care because they only care about incumbents. But that's not a good way to build goodwill with the people on the left whose votes you're going to be able to ask
for. And also, these primary elections are not just primaries in these states also. Like, that's the thing. Right. Like, you know, we got the results from the Wisconsin primary this week. You know, there was a huge
judgment.
There was a huge Supreme Court race there that is going to have national implications, because basically, like, the issue at hand was whether they're going to, like, purge a bunch of hundreds of thousands of people from the voter rolls in Wisconsin, basically. And, like, it wasn't necessarily competitive, but, like, a reasonably competitive primary going on there. Like, would as many Democrats have bothered to show up and vote in that for that Supreme Court race? Also, you know, a lot of the mayor of Milwaukee, that was his general election. So I'm sure that was the case for a lot of other, like, cities in Wisconsin. And I'm just using Wisconsin as one example. But that's the same throughout.
Had this insane election.
You know, like, you think about our primary. It had a million different things on there, and those weren't primaries, many of them. I mean,
and
there were props on
there.
And also,
we have a jungle primary.
So have a jungle primary.
So, is the difference between Democrats getting on the ballot at all or not.
Right, exactly. So you really do I agree with you. They are doing it for the reasons that you're saying, but it's not a good idea at all.
It's short-sighted.
It's completely short-sighted. So, and I think that's the way that you actually, I think that of the list that you're going to go on about, I think is the best way to try and sell people on why to have the rest of these primaries. Because I think it's a thing that, like, you're not going to get a Biden supporter being like, oh, well, like, everybody should have the chance to vote, because, like, they're going to be like, well, Sanders can't overtake him, blah, blah, blah. They're going to, like, give that talking point at you. But if you can be like, well, do you want Democrats to show up in the New York primary and reelect, you know, so-and-so, because, like, they should get to go back to Congress or whatever? Like, that, I think, is a winning argument that people just don't think about. So, like, I feel like that's the best way in.
It's the epitome of DNC short-sightedness.
Totally.
Because it is they're going to be angry when people don't show up to vote, but they're going to have done everything they could to suppress the vote. And this is a suppressive measure.
Totally.
And here's a sort of the other flip side of that is, I think I might blow some of your minds by pointing out that Biden does not have the number of delegates he needs to win the nomination
yet.
He has 1,305 delegates. He needs 1,991 to win. I know that polling was showing that was an insurmountable obstacle. I get it. I can read. But I think that if, you know, he has not actually won anything according to the rules and the process that the Democrats themselves set up. And so the process is being perceived as a sham because it actually is a sham, because it has not completed yet. And we have declared a winner. We have basically coronated someone. And when you're and that's when, like, if you're about to tell me that he won fair and square when I use the word coronation, then you are technically and actually incorrect, because he has not won anything yet.
Right.
But so if Biden's win was so assured that the DNC feels confident just getting everyone out of the race, then they should have let the process play out. The process is important, because unity is a process. And one of the things that can bring about unity is everyone feeling like they got a chance to participate. Yep. Right now, the second biggest delegate hall in the country, which is New York State, has not voted. And by the way, just for some context, wouldn't have voted until April 28th anyway. So,
they
postponed their primary, but we're still early enough that many states would not have voted anyway yet in the process. This is much earlier than we normally come around to one candidate, and it's too early. But I've been to one party states. I've spent time in, you know, several post-communist economies where one party gets reelected to everything. And this feels like an authoritarian kind of regime's process. Tailoring somebody who's the clear winner while technically allowing opponents but not actually allowing them to compete, and then basically telling them they have to drop out at the end. It changes the assumptions under which we operate in this process. And people are already feeling powerless and desperate. And so I think, you know, one reason they might be seeing the left not looking like they're really willing to come along is that my feeling is that people really need to make noise about that, because this shouldn't be allowed to happen again. There is no circumstance under which this was an acceptable way to elect someone. This was not a democratic process. Yeah. And so if the DNC didn't want to let the process play out because we're in a pandemic and Trump is, you know, because of all these exceptional things, one thing that we need to be clear on is that this can never happen again. And because if this ever happens, if this is how it works now, then we don't have a democratic primary. We don't have a democratic process. What we have is the old kind of democratic primary where the party bigwigs met in a secret smoky room and picked the candidate, and we had nothing to say about it.
I mean, I agree. And I also think, you know, and we have talked, and you specifically have talked about, you know, national primaries. And I think that, like, you know, you sort of like look back at the way that this primary played out. I mean, let's imagine for a second that South Carolina happened the week that Nevada did, and Nevada happened the week that South Carolina did, you know, 3 days before Super Tuesday, in a blowout for Sanders across all demographics. We might be like literally in a very different place right now. And that's literally just,
if California had voted first, we might be in a different place right now.
Right. When you look at sort of like these like weird sort of like momentum shifts that come out of these things, and like how many tickets like leave one specific place, is completely bonkers. And I know that's how we've done it for a billion years, but like, if we want to get better at this, then we should like look at things that we could do. And it doesn't make any sense to sort of like wait one thing more than another thing when, you know, half of the states don't even get a chance to vote anyway. Like, we've declared that South Carolina, in the last two elections now, we've declared that South Carolina is the state that we're ultimately going to let us pick who the
South Carolina, we should point out, does not vote Democratic in the
Never Dem- has or will.
Never will or has. So while, of course, they should be heard from in the primary process, they should not be a, they should not be the decisive state.
Right.
They aren't representative of the Democratic electorate because
they live in a,
everybody
talks about like how Iowa has outweighed, power in the election process because they
all
get to
those
go first.
Early states,
but like
are
it's
nonsense.
Been the last two election cycles, it has been proven to not be Iowa. It's been South Carolina.
Yeah, no, and I, you know, also people forget, because a lot of this has been people blaming the caucus because they bring out an activist vote and blah blah blah. But Biden placed fifth in New Hampshire, so there was a huge shift that happened in South Carolina, a state that once again does not vote Democratic in the general, either way, however this process began, I think you have to let the process complete. I don't think that you get to ask me or anyone, certainly not my parents, who have not gotten to vote yet.
Yeah.
But you don't get to ask any of us to suddenly shift perspective to being, and it's not, this is not like, this is not an either or where like I'm enthusiastic about Donald Trump or something.
Well, right.
This is just like an explanation of why I am so livid with the Democratic Party. I'm so livid with the Biden campaign that I can't see past that right now.
Yeah.
And I don't think you get to ask me to if you're not going to participate in the process we agreed upon.
No, and I agree. And you certainly shouldn't shame anybody in a state that hasn't voted for voting for Bernie Sanders. Like, don't get mad at those people, because that's insane.
Well, and I think also there was maybe this feeling, because this is how the vote blue no matter who contingent works, where if Sanders endorsed Biden, everyone would just come along. And now they're like clutching their pearls that the Sanders coalition was more disorganized and was a little bit less unified on that kind, you know, was not willing to just follow him into any arbitrary battle. And I have two minds about this, because I'm not one of those Sanders people that's like angry at him for doing this. I see exactly what he did. And I think Bernie Sanders is someone that I at least trust makes the best moral choice for the situation that he's in and the best choice for the movement that he can in every decision he makes. So I just think that we had different needs in this moment, because right now Bernie Sanders is in the Senate trying to build goodwill so that he can have some, you know, effect on the stimulus negotiations. So for him, I think getting calls from the party brass telling him that he's ruining everyone's lives was not an option right now, because he's actually needed in a sort of active governing role right now, and he needs the goodwill to make that happen.
Yeah.
That's not the position I'm in.
Right. There's also, you know, he would never admit this, and I think a lot of people probably even within the movement might even get upset with me at saying this, but like there's self-preservation on his part involved here too.
Of course.
I mean, like he knows
he's a sitting senator.
He's a sitting senator. And also I think that he know, like to run for president twice, there, you can't deny that there has to be like some level of ego involved.
Right.
Like there just has to be like, that's would, you know,
yes,
it'd be crazy to argue against that. And I think that, like, he knows to a degree, whether he agrees with it or not, and he certainly doesn't, that sort of, you know, his, the movement that he led sort of, like, got us Donald Trump, which is insane. But, like, I think just personally he would like to change that perception of himself.
Wait, you mean the movement he led didn't bring us Donald Trump?
No, I think people blame him.
Oh, people blame him.
People
I was
blame
like,
him
oh,
for
it
that.
Sounded like you were saying that you that the movement that he led did lead to Donald Trump. And I was like,
No. I'm
operating
saying that
this
people,
podcast very
people
differently
blame
than I
him.
Thought.
People blame him and his movement for Donald Trump, which is ridiculous for everything that we have said on this podcast for the last 4 years.
Here's
but
some news
like,
flashes.
If he can, if there's anything that he can do to change the writing of his own history, I think he would like to do it.
Yeah. Here's a news.
But we don't have to worry about that because
for everyone
we don't have
currently.
To care.
If we're gonna be blamed no matter what happens, unless something good happens. So if Donald Trump gets reelected and it's because of all these missteps that I just laid out from the Biden campaign and
we're
the fact that
blamed.
He can't find any enthusiasm and the fact that they basically told the entire young wing of the party to go fuck themselves, we're gonna get blamed. If Joe Biden gets elected but doesn't accomplish anything, we're gonna get blamed. If Joe Biden gets elected but does accomplish things and they're all terrible, we're going to get blamed. I mean, we're going to get blamed literally no matter what happens. We're going to be told that our misery is our own fault. Don't let yourself be gaslit about that.
Yeah, totally.
Is the one thing I will say because that, you know, I remember the very early on in me and Brent's friendship, I think I was the person who burst the Nader bubble for you where I just sort of defiantly was like, no, Ralph Nader is not the reason that Al Gore lost the election. Al Gore is the reason that Al Gore lost the election. And I like can't listen to any argument that suggests anything of that logic other, you know, anything like alongside that logic.
Yeah, no, you are.
And I mean, this was like, you know, over a decade ago or whatever. Yeah. But I feel like there are a lot of times where, especially on the left, but anywhere as a political citizen, you are going to be gaslit. There was a very popular article going on about how, or going around last week about how we're all going to be gaslit about the pandemic,
right,
and we are.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I, you know, relate to that very much as a 9/11 survivor because we were repeatedly gaslit about the dangerous conditions we were put in. You get gaslit a lot as a person. don't let yourself be gaslit about your own political agency and the political reality that you see in front of you. This wasn't a fair process, and it is okay to think that. And I have one final point that I think is the final mistake I want to mention with the Biden campaign, and then we'll move on to real news. I think giving him this long lead time is a huge mistake. Wow. We are not in October. We are operating right now like it's October, and he's talking about choosing a cabinet, and I think the longer we have to, A, sit with his record, because I think a lot of people probably don't realize what his record is. I think a lot of people are going to find out he wrote the 94 crime bill months from now when it's too, when we're already really far down a road and we've invested too much in this. But also, we have 6 months of hearing about Hunter Biden and fucking, you know, Ukraine and Russia. Like, we have 6 months of hearing about that coming up. And I think the narrative that we could have had coming from the right is that the Democrats are disorganized. But instead, the narrative we're going to have is the Democrats are corrupt. And I know that that's the pot calling the kettle black coming from Trump. I mean, obviously. But the Democrats are disorganized is much easier to roll with. And we're just going to have too much time for them to build the Democrats are corrupt narrative. And we've just handed them all these tools to do it.
I agree. And
also, that is going to be problematic with the kind of voters who are sort of essentially activist voters, who some of whom are on the right and kind of swing wildly between the extreme right and the extreme left. This is just going to be problematic for how we're perceived.
I agree. And he also, you know, we've settled on his foil early. You know, I mean, he does so much better always when he has a foil. It's why he's not doing well in the coronavirus right now, because it's hard to make a deadly virus your foil.
Exactly.
You know, but it will not be hard to make Joe Biden that.
He was the reason Joe Biden was doing poorly at the beginning of this race was because he was Trump's foil. That I mean, and
And that, not speaking in complete sentences, but
right. Well, he's going to continue doing that. So newsflash to everyone, that's going to continue.
I know.
But yeah, and also Joe Biden is going to have time for more gaffes than any one person should have for. And we have concerning stats about his coronavirus, the response to his coronavirus presence coming up later in the podcast. But needless to say, a sort of quick spoiler on that is that fewer Americans trust Joe Biden on the coronavirus than Donald Trump at this moment. So I just want to point out that his absence is not necessarily making our hearts grow fonder. in any case,
yeah,
we have apparently another stimulus coming. Nancy Pelosi says Congress is close to a deal to give additional funding to that small business paycheck protection program, which ran out of money within instance, and also gave a bunch of money to like huge corporations, basically.
Yeah, and we're never going to find out about that because like the Democrats want to put more money in it, as do Republicans. But there's some sticking points because the Democrats also want to add $100 billion for hospitals and $150 billion for state governments. We talked about that a couple weeks ago about and food assistance. So there's discussion to put $250 billion into this Paycheck Protection Program, but that hospital money and the money for state governments has been a sticking point between them and the Republicans. But yeah, this ran out of money very, very, very quickly, and there, we don't know where it went. Which was the whole thing that we wanted with this, was that we wanted to know where this money was going. We wanted transparency here. And the Democrats are now sort of like, hey, maybe before we put another, you know, because we'll have put over a half of $1 trillion into this by the time if they add this extra $250 billion in there, you know, like, hey, where's it going?
Yeah.
Senate Democrats signed a letter of some sort and like released a statement, and they were just sort of like, show us where the damn money went. They said, quote, as Congress works to provide critical funding for these programs, we write to ask that you provide additional data and information about how loans and grants have been distributed, because nobody knows.
Well, we do know that Ruth Chris Steakhouse got $20 million from it. Yeah. So we at least know that.
Yeah, there's some large restaurant chains that have been getting this money, which people are not happy about, rightfully. Yeah. And they're not the only one. There's others. So it seems like there's some questionable small businesses out there.
These are people, by the way, who often, when you have humanitarian needs, don't want to give money because they won't be sure where the money is going. Right. Like, that was a holdup with the 9/11 health bill, as they kept talking about fraud. And there's no documented fraud in the program for the Victims Compensation Fund. But they kept going on and on about fraud. Like, if we can't root out fraud, then we can't afford to give money to these people.
Right. We don't care about this fraud. Because the fraud is going to corporations as opposed to people.
Exactly. When people get money, though, they have a lot of fraud concerns.
Right. They're worried that somebody might make a little bit more money on unemployment than they would on their actual paycheck.
Well, and also
throwing $500 billion at, Ruth Chris is fine.
Yeah. Why not? We need a chain steakhouse, Brent, in these trying times.
Sure.
We need it. Speaking of, there's no more talk of any more bailout money for people.
Yeah, no.
The $1,200, which hasn't even come to most of us, is apparently all we're ever going to get. And I would also point out, as someone
who has...
they're
having to print checks with Donald Trump's
signature. No, and also there were just like huge glitches in the system that led to people who qualified not being, not being paid. But also the unemployment money is taking a long time to arrive in the hands of people. I can confirm myself. And then also... because there is not a lot of understanding about how self-employment income is supposed to qualify or not qualify, a lot of people, myself included, are being rejected on that basis.
Yep.
So,
That's become a huge issue. People who are self-employed, also people sort of like who work in the gig economy. I was reading an article just the other day about like how that has become, they supposedly sort of like relaxed a lot of those rules, but it has become, it's just making it harder for those people to actually file. And they don't actually get the money.
They have not been able. And there's also no way to easily appeal an unemployment claim. So if you get an incorrect determination or a determination that feels like it should be different, there's like the process is like impossible to navigate. So far, millions of contractors, gig workers, myself included, haven't gotten a dime from any of this, but still can't work. So it's Exciting times out there, and it is getting more exciting because last week, 5.2 million new unemployment claims.
Yeah, you're in a very large boat with about 22 million people.
That's actually, right. 22 now. Million people. I think that was like something like a huge that something like 50% of the workforce or something is now on unemployment. I mean, like an amount of people that is crazy.
Yeah. Well, and also that's a huge, that 22, well, so now over the last 4 weeks, we're up to 22 million if we count last week's of 5.2 million. And that's a huge milestone because since the Great Recession in 2008-2009, over those, that 10, 11 years, the economy has added 21.5 million jobs. So that entire job growth over the course of the entire period post-Great Recession is gone in 4 weeks.
Plus 500,000 additional jobs, which when you, if you remember our frequent reporting on the fake jobs numbers, you would know that a 1 month loss of just 500,000 jobs would have been devastating to the economy.
Oh yeah, for sure.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's that plus 21.5 million.
But also right, exactly. And to your point, you know, we're starting to get some statistics on how this money, the unemployment money is going out and whether it's actually going out and how many states have actually sort of done this because, you know, the first stimulus bill gave an additional $600 payment to people who are filing for unemployment, but only 29 states so far have actually distributed any of that additional money.
Yeah.
And that's because some of these, it's just these states are like on these totally archaic systems for unemployment benefits that are like 40, 50 years old. I think I can't remember if we actually talked about it on the podcast, but I know you and I talked about it. I sent you that article. Like New Jersey was like looking for programmers for like this.
A few states were
because like they're processing unemployment on this technology that's literally from the 1960s. Yeah. So that has been a problem. But the Department of Labor is like estimating that only 60% of people who, of those 22 million who have filed unemployment claims over the last month, are actually receiving any benefits.
And so, I bet that that doesn't mean that they have gotten paid yet. I bet that means that they have qualified for the program because it takes an additional couple weeks to get the check after you have qualified and gone through all of these things. So what we mean is that rent for May is coming up.
Yeah.
In just a week or two.
And you are already probably laid off in March anyway.
Right. And you're now being asked to pay your second month of rent without income with no end in sight.
And you probably haven't received $1,200 either.
Right. So you are behind the eight ball and you are only going to be more behind the eight ball. And also, by the way,
you don't have health insurance.
You don't have health insurance. And asking people to eat through their savings is bad for the economy, too, because that means that every single person coming out of this is going to be essentially living on the edge. Which means that they don't spend money the way that you want for the economy to be. I mean, like, all of this is like a self-fulfilling prophecy where, like, if you don't get money into people's hands, there's no money circulating. And then when there's no money circulating, then no one can make the money that people would have been spending on things. And it's all based on moods. None of it's real.
Well, and also people aren't actually able to, like, spend this money, too. There were a lot of reports this week, too, of the people who were getting direct deposits. Banks were keeping the money if you were either overdrawn or like had past due payments or anything like that. So like these people aren't even able to, and like, look, I get it. That to a large degree, that's probably what people would have spent that money on anyway, was sort of paying bills that they needed to be paid, but they also need to eat. They need to do things that would actually, and that stimulates the economy. Like that's what I keep going back to.
Well, you know, we mentioned your bank back doesn't do shit for the economy, but buying some food does.
Right, which is, and that is again why it sort of would have made more sense had this been a universal, you know, it would have been first off easy to process because like literally everyone just would have gotten it. So there would have been less of this just sort of like making sure that either a check is being printed or like whether your social security number is like registered with the IRS or whatever, however they're trying to figure out how to get this money out. But like, you know, I have, and I truly realize how blessed I am to like continue to be working and making my salary. But to that point, had I been given $1,200, I would have hired a contractor to do some repairs on my condo that I've been wanting to do, or I would have bought, you know, some furniture that I also need to like have done also, in this place. Like there's
given how precarious things are, you also could lose your job next week, not make so much money at the end of the year that you didn't need the $1,200, and then discover that you needed it after.
Totally.
You know? I mean, that's dumb. Doing means testing for a bailout is
so
stupid.
Silly. Yeah. When this is affecting all of us in some way,
shape, and we're essentially talking about 5% of households that aren't going to get the money. So we're not talking about that many people. We're just talking about people that could have spent this money hiring the rest of us to do shit.
Right.
It could have gotten this money circulating.
So dumb. People don't get it.
People don't get it. One of those people being Donald Trump.
Oh, my God. Well, there's a lot of things that he doesn't get. This reminded me of
numbers being one.
Right. He's having a lot of issues with knowing how many people are in places. Because remember, a couple of weeks ago, he claimed that, like, you know, South Korea, like, hadn't done that much testing. And there were, like, you know, claimed that there were, you know, 700 gazillion people in Seoul, Korea or something. Like, and right. He was, like, his estimation was, like, so wildly off.
It was based on the elevation of
right, I know.
Seoul or something.
Now, this one's a doozy, actually, on a lot of levels. But apparently he thinks that he has saved billions of people's lives.
It's interesting because we don't have even one single billion in America.
Right. There's 0 billion people in America. Right. Exactly. And there's only 8 in the entire world.
Yes. And many of those billions live in East Asia, where he's basically like working on destroying our relationship.
No.
So.
Right.
And a remaining 1 billion live in India or the Indian subcontinent, where he's also not being super helpful. So.
Right. But he was talking about, at one of his press conferences, he said that, you know, based on a lot of models, that there could be between 100 and 220,000 people die. And I think people are feeling fairly good about where we're at because the models are, like, getting better. But, like, also, I think we're up to 70. So it's like, those models probably aren't going to end up being that wrong because we're probably going to get to 100,000.
Yeah. We're going to have a second wave of all of this going to ruin everything. We'll tell you that later too.
But he said, I really believe it could have been billions of people who died had we not done what we did. We made a lot of good decisions.
Billions
of people. Right. Like a quarter
that would require
the world.
I was going to say, that would require this to have a 25% death rate.
Right. Well, and there's a lot of questions about what the death rate is too. And I think that
those questions don't lead you to 25% though.
No.
That's the thing.
They don't.
The questions don't get anywhere to near 25%.
If there's any questions about what the death rate are, the question would be, is it actually as high as we think it
is? That's right. Right. When you're not doing any testing, you can't find any minor cases. So.
Right, exactly. Well, and that's the thing. I think there was just recently a study like out of Stanford about in Santa Clara County, which was one of the early ones that has been hit, and they sort of like did antibodies testing. And they're basically showing that, like, maybe anywhere between, like, 50 and 75% of more people than actually tested positive for it who, like, showed any symptoms actually have it because so many people had the antibodies to it, which is sort of scary that a lot of people have it. But
I already have the antibodies.
Well, I know. Well, but also, like, you know, there's a lot of questions about whether the antibodies, like, actually
protect you. Right. I hope I don't have them if they
causing you to. But there's just so many questions about what this thing is still.
And I read a very interesting article recently that was saying that they have that, you know, we were all told as asthmatics, we were all told like stay in your homes and don't go out and, you know, hide under your covers. And they're finding that of the sort of comorbidities that are seeming to lead to fatal outcomes, a very small percentage of them are actually asthmatics. And asthmatics make up a lot of the population, especially in the populations that we're seeing higher death rates in. So especially in poorer communities, especially in African-American community. And, you know, I think what they're sort of discovering is that the risk factors are that they thought were the risk factors because they were obvious because it's a respiratory disease. So, like, of course, asthmatics should be careful. And, like, obviously, if you're an asthmatic, be careful because it's a respiratory disease.
Yeah, you don't want a respiratory infection.
Right. But they're finding that the fatal outcomes actually are often people who have kidney disease. It's like things that you don't put together. It's a lot of diabetics. It's a lot of people with heart issues, which usually those kind of cardiovascular issues go hand in hand with respiratory issues because all of it is about getting oxygen into your body.
Yeah.
But I'm also not a doctor, so I know that that's not literally what happens. But so they're fine. Every day we're getting a new study that shows something that we would never have guessed about the disease.
Yeah.
But so
one study that you won't see is that Trump saved billions of lives.
That will never come out.
We can guarantee you that that study does not exist.
That's right.
At least in a peer-reviewed scientific journal.
Yeah, you it might, may exist you might at some see point. It
in a graph or a propaganda video next week during right. the
if you see it on Drudge,
one of the press conferences.
Then just know that no, that was not peer-reviewed.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You don't even need scientific peers to peer-review yeah. that. You just need any peers yep. to review it.
Exactly. Well,
surprise.
Turns out that stay-at-home orders are working. You know, oh. we already had some proof of this by the fact that, you know, California seems to be doing a good job. There are other places that seems to have, plateauing or flattening of the curve. We talked a couple weeks ago about, like, how Minnesota was doing sort of, like, the best of all of the upper Midwest states, and they were sort of the earliest of those states to put some of these orders in place. But some of the other states now we're starting to see numbers from them, and they have all been having huge upticks.
Yeah. So we're talking about states that resisted stay-at-home orders for much longer than the rest of the country, and almost all of them saw huge increases in the number of cases. So in Oklahoma, they saw a 53% increase in cases over the past week, and they're already talking about lifting their stay-at-home order.
Yeah, they're
and there was an increase in testing there, so part of that is due to an increase in testing, but also part of that is due to the fact that they were not staying at home. 60% increase in Arkansas, 74% in Nebraska, 82% in Iowa. And then South Dakota is having a huge outbreak. Their case number went up 205%. And also has led to the largest pork processing plant in the country being closed because there was an outbreak there. And now, like, basically everyone in Sioux Falls has coronavirus.
Right. Well, and so these numbers are troubling for a couple reasons. Because one, it really sort of undermines, you know, we're going to talk about Trump's cockamamie plan to, you know, reopen
America.
The country. Like, we're getting there in a second. But part of his thinking here is that there are places that just don't have quite as bad of a situation here because, like, they're not New York. He keeps saying that places aren't New York. You know, Arkansas is not New York. And so this really undermines that notion that, like, we're just ready to go back to work because clearly we're not, because these places that didn't do what they should have done, you know, we're seeing what's happening there.
Well, also actually there was a really interesting op-ed in the Daily News, the New York Daily News today that, or maybe yesterday, that was about how it may not be true that New York's density was the issue, because the second densest city in the country is San Francisco, and they have almost no deaths from coronavirus and a very low case count. And when you look at cities that have comparable numbers of, you know, comparable occupant per room rates, LA has a higher occupant per room rate than New York, which means that people actually are living in fewer rooms here than they are in New York, which is wild, but here we are. When you look at density rates, San Francisco is not as dense as New York, but is incredibly dense and is the second densest city in the country, the peninsula of San Francisco.
Yeah.
And they were able to, you know, keep their case rate low. Yeah. There are other cities that use
They also started
transit.
Social distancing like 5 days before
Well,
New
and
York
that's
City
basically
did.
What this op-ed writer says is that we're going to remember, you know, right now we're remembering Cuomo as like some heroic master of galvanizing people. We're going to remember him as having cost us, thousands of lives because he waited so long to act.
I think so, too. I mean, London Breed is the real hero in that story, really,
yeah.
the
no,
mayor
absolutely.
Of San Francisco.
And that's what they say. They say London Breed made quicker decisions, and London Breed saved lives from doing that. And, you know, New York State and New York City waited for days while the case rates were climbing before shutting anything down. And, you know, they had the disadvantage of not having another place in the States go through this before them, but they had the advantage of seeing what happened in Italy. So they knew what could be coming. And they, you know, Cuomo was saying as recently as mid-March that New York is different. America is different. It won't be like Italy. It's different here. And it, surprise, turned out not to be different. And so they were sort of, this op-ed is sort of saying that it's not, you know, actually going to be density that's a determinant here. It's going to be policy and action from state governments. And if that's the case, then it doesn't matter if you're South Dakota.
Right,
because
exactly.
Because rural communities are often very close-knit, often spend a lot of time interacting with each other. And if one person gets coronavirus and gives it to the entire town, then it doesn't really matter if you live in a low-density neighborhood.
That's the thing. And, you know, I think there's a, you know, the governor of South Dakota said something to the effect, and while it's not wrong on its face, is she said that it wouldn't have, doing social distancing and stay-at-home orders would not have affected the Tyson plant because that right. those people are considered, you know, essential workers. And while that is true, had you been able to sort of like manage whether the people who were coming into your plant were social distancing or not, like you probably would not have had that outbreak had you been sort of like taking care of all of your citizens. Like, yes, they still would yeah. have had to have been going to work, but they might not have been going to work with coronavirus.
Right. And they also might not have stayed at work long enough to infect 300 people. Right. They might have been encouraged because it would have been the society's priority yeah. to make sure everyone was healthy, to take time off as soon as they felt sick. I mean, there could have been all these other factors that
yeah.
diminished the effect, even if someone did get sick at the Tyson plant.
Sure. And this is a problem nationwide, because I think, yeah. You can sort of like, okay, well, it's just South Dakota. But the reason that they, as you mentioned, it's the largest pork processing plant.
I think they process something like 5% of the nation's pork or yeah, something, in which is Iowa, a huge thing for one plant.
Right. In Iowa, multiple Tyson food plants have been yeah. shut down.
Oh, right. The South Dakota one is Smithfield Foods. The Iowa ones are Tyson.
Yeah.
We're getting our pork processing mixed up.
And this is not there's other places that are also – there was a huge beef plant in Colorado this week. And Colorado, I think, did a little bit better of a job. So, like, it is sort of it's understandable why a factory like this might have spread, which is a problem. But, like, you know, there are now sort of, like, new concerns about the food supply. And even if the food supply is going to be ultimately okay, there's certainly no way – that groceries sort of like don't start becoming more expensive.
Yeah.
And that is certainly not what we need right now when everybody is struggling financially and nobody is working and nobody can get food from the food banks. Like, you've seen all the visuals this week of, you know, food yeah. banks just having miles and miles and miles of cars and like running out of food because like people can't go to the grocery store. I mean, so like we can't be living in a world where we're like not having enough food to feed people also
yeah.
because so these governors, all of whom are GOP governors, of course.
Obviously.
Need to get their fucking act together. And the president, which is the next story that we're doing here, needs to realize that we can't just all be going back to work right now. Certainly yeah. not in a pork processing plant.
No. Well, and also, I mean, I think one thing that we need to remember is considering how much of the food supply comes from the middle of the country. And I actually think this is why it was such an advantage that California social distanced so early. It wasn't just saving lives in the cities here, but so much of the food supply is grown in California.
Oh,
California
yeah,
I mean, grows a huge amount of our food. And so it is really important that we do everything we can to keep essential farm workers safe in their everyday lives so that they are able to continue to work, because we also need to keep having food
yeah.
for society. And already these are people that are much more likely to be underpaid and overworked and not have job security and not, in some cases, especially in the farming sector, not have citizenship, not have access to the benefits of citizenship. Like, you know, we certainly should not be also putting them in a situation where in order to make their living, they have to get coronavirus.
Right.
Which is in order to live in the society they live in. They have to, I mean, like, good
yeah.
Lord.
Yeah.
My mom was actually reminding me today that apparently grocery clerks used to be a job where you made like a really decent living.
Huh.
My uncle was saying that he had been a grocery clerk early in his, you know, 20s or whatever, and he was like, I had never made so much money in my life. I was in a union. We kept striking, but we somehow just kept getting hired. Like, the wages were great. I didn't know what to do with all the money, so I spent it because I was terrible with money. And he was like, and then I became a reporter and I took a huge pay cut.
Wow.
So I was thinking about that because my mom was like, you know, I think we actually did used to treat grocery store workers as essential workers in the sense that we allowed them the dignity of work that of compensation that equates to the value of what they offer, which is a lot.
Yeah.
As they are an incredibly important part of our society. And so this is actually something we used to know, and that changed, I think, largely because of the sort of corporatization of the grocery business and the way that, you know, huge big box stores in the model of like Walmart took over much of America.
Yeah.
So local grocers didn't exist, and mid-sized grocers weren't regional anymore, and Ralph's is owned by Kroger, and everyone's falling apart.
Right.
In any case, Donald Trump is bored of all of this. So he wants us to get back to work so that we can stop complaining to him about how we're not working.
Yeah.
And talking about coronavirus. And so they released a plan that is implementable on a state-by-state or county-by-county basis, according to them. So he did leave it up to local government's authority, which is funny because earlier he had been going on about how he had total authority to tell governors to do whatever he wanted. Right. Turned out not to be true. And then so we backed off that claim. But in any case, this seemed like to me it did two things, neither of which were good. One was it created an expectation that we would be going back to normal when we shouldn't be, thereby giving us all coronavirus.
Yeah.
The other was sort of simultaneously somehow indicating to us that actually this is going to go on forever. Because it goes on, like the sort of phases upon which we reopen all sound really lame. So it like laid out how lame the recovery is going to be, even in a circumstance where we go back too early and don't pay attention to science, which is, I think, just a downer for anyone, whether you believe we should stay home or not. This plan doesn't work for you. Basically, you have to meet a bunch of criteria to begin the process that they released. The criteria is that you have to have a downward trajectory of influenza-like illnesses reported within a 14-day period, but only 14 days, which doesn't seem enough. A downward trajectory of documented cases within a 14-day period, a downward trajectory of COVID-like cases within a 14-day period, or a downward trajectory of positive tests as a percentage of total tests. You have to be able to treat all patients with crisis care, and you have to have a robust testing program in place for at-risk healthcare workers. But then the phases that we're going to open up under are fucking lame.
Yeah.
The first one opens restaurants, movie theaters, and large sporting venues as long as they can maintain social distancing, which, newsflash, they can't. But right. Gyms, schools, daycare centers, and bars don't stay open. You can go back to doing elective surgeries as deemed appropriate. But you can't visit your relatives in senior living facilities. And also, all vulnerable people have to keep sheltering in place. And then, but also members of households with vulnerable residents, quote, should be aware that by returning to work or other environments where distancing is not practical, they could carry the virus back home. So just be aware, but don't do anything without awareness,
but
basically.
Still just go to work.
Be nervous, but don't take any action. It says employers should keep allowing employees to telework, and everyone should keep practicing social distancing. Then phase two.
Mm-hmm.
This is for states and regions with, quote, no evidence of a rebound that, quote, satisfy the gating criteria a second time. So basically after 30 days of having a downward trajectory, but not a downward case, not a low case count. I think a downward trajectory is different than a low case count, which I think is kind of an important distinction here. Because if you have a downward trajectory, but a third of your society has coronavirus, then everyone's just going to get it again as soon as they go back into the world.
Right, exactly.
So, I mean, that doesn't help anyone.
Right, because New York City is still on a...
They've had a downward trajectory for days now. That doesn't mean that it's not...
Right, once they get to 14 days of that, like, they shouldn't all just decide to go back outside.
No, exactly. Like, hundreds of people die a day there of coronavirus. Like, they should be staying inside longer.
Yeah.
But then schools can reopen, daycare centers, camps, non-essential travel could resume. But you still can't go to senior care facilities or hospitals. And the large venues that were opened in phase one can ease some of their social distancing protocols.
To a moderate level? Like, what are the differences between the levels of social distancing?
Can you
go from, like, 6 to 4 feet or something? Or, like, what?
Yeah, right? It's like, you can finally get within enough distance to catch coronavirus, but only if someone is singing instead of talking or something. Like,
right.
Phase three, that's for states with no evidence of rebound that satisfy the gating criteria a third time. So 45 days after you've started this nonsense, anyone can just go back to doing anything they want, basically. Which is, I feel like, not a one-size-fits-all strategy, but also at the same time makes returning to normal sound like the longest and most arduous process possible. So it somehow does two things at once where it, like, makes it sound like, A, your restaurant business is not going to be able to come back on one third of the customers.
Right.
Your movie theater is not going to operate at a profit with 7 people in every theater.
Right.
So it's got all the disadvantages of the time we're in right now.
But right. And are they going to continue helping these companies also?
Right.
Or like, start helping them, I guess, if they haven't yet.
But you do have the advantage then as a movie theater of becoming a new disease vector. So that's exciting. Like, basically, it just gives you the chance to be a disease vector without the chance to make a living. The other problematic thing is he was saying that states might be able to do this before May 1st. All the doctors were like, no,
No, you can't be doing that.
You can't be doing that. Yeah. But, you know, some of these governors are up to shenanigans. They don't care. But also, the plan didn't specify what the metrics communities would need to use to determine if they're having a resurgence in infections. So I don't really know how you're supposed to know when you no longer meet the criteria. Like, is it one day? I mean, our test numbers go up and down every day.
Yeah, they do.
Also, none of the criteria is having a robust enough testing program that any person can get tested, which is actually what we need to do to open up.
Right.
That's kind of what the Democrats are saying.
This sort of like and it also just sort of goes back to what we were talking about earlier today, where there's just still so much unknown about this. Like, how many people have had it? Like, do you know, people keep talking about like testing and like, yes, we need testing, but like a lot of people are talking about antibodies testing, but like
it's not reliable.
It's still highly unclear whether like you can actually get it again just because you have the antibodies. Like, are those actually like ensuring that, like,
well, also because people keep testing positive after testing negative because our testing isn't even that accurate, so it's like kind of a mess.
Yeah,
because that even the testing has like a 30% false negative rate.
Right.
So like, it's all a mess.
Yeah.
In more promising news, we have a bunch of mini nation states forming within the nation.
Yes.
We have pacts forming all over the country between governors about how they'll coordinate to reopen. So it is promising that the entire West Coast is going to coordinate our reopen, and a lot of the Northeast is going to coordinate their reopen, and even some of the Midwest is going to do that, probably led by Ohio because they're the only ones with a reasonable governor.
Yep.
And he's a Republican. He's just like a man who wears glasses, so I guess he believes science. I don't know.
Yep.
It's just that's like it. Mike DeWine wears glasses, so I guess that makes him believe in science.
Yeah.
But a lot of people, I mean, the way this is polling, a lot of people are really scared about opening too soon, too. People don't want to open too soon.
Right. Yeah, we're at 58% of registered voters were concerned about loosening the restrictions.
Yeah.
Compared to 32% that think that they'll stay in place for too long. All of them, that entirety of the 32%, presumably people who were protesting this last week.
That's right. 3%, by the way, said they're concerned about both scenarios. So 3% of people feel very confused. And
well, you know what? That's not surprising considering the misinformation campaign that's been going on from the White House. So, like, you might be confused.
That's right.
I feel bad for those people because, like, it doesn't mean they're stupid. It means they're probably paying attention.
They're reading the news is the problem.
They're reading the news.
Well, and this is all from an NBC News Wall Street Journal poll, and they also broke it down by party. So unsurprisingly, Democrats were much more concerned, and a majority of independents were also concerned about the coronavirus. Only 48% of Republicans had more concern about the economy.
No,
only 39% were more worried about the virus. 48% were more concerned about the economy. I said that backwards.
Right.
But that's interesting because they are voting for a party that almost always leads to a recession. Like, voting for Republicans makes you not care about, it makes you not someone who cares about the economy, because the economy suffers literally under every Republican regime. Yeah. So, sorry. But also, the number of people who are worried about coronavirus affecting them personally has gone up pretty significantly. So whereas about last month, 15% of people said they were very worried that it would strike a family member, and 38% said they were somewhat worried. Now 33% of people say they're very worried about coronavirus striking a family member, and 40% said they're somewhat worried. And I think this is actually an important distinction. This is like, we're starting to get to the point where like people know people who have either died of coronavirus or have had coronavirus.
Yep.
And I think this is going to make it difficult for there to be like enough of a community of people who want to open up the economy too early to make it a meaningful movement, because some of these people are going to think they're invincible because they don't know anyone yet who has coronavirus. And then they're going to find out that their uncle who lives in rural Arkansas has it. And then they're going to be like, wait a minute, is this a Democratic hoax? And then they're going to think nothing. They're not going to think positive thoughts. But I mean, there's going to be a point at which, especially as the states that are seeing expand, you know, huge growth in the number of cases, are going to sort of increasingly be Republican strongholds. They're going to be rural states. Like, I think we're going to start seeing people being more and more concerned that this is going to affect them personally. So
yeah. There were some other interesting poll numbers in this poll, because they also pulled, you know, they pulled the presidential race, which had Biden beating Trump 49-22%. 49-42, excuse me.
49-22 is a great number, and I know, not the right number.
Yeah, not the right number. No. Right. It should be that. But,
right. That's anyway. If we were all being reasonable, it would be.
45% of people thought that Donald Trump has not handled the pandemic well, and is still not doing so. Right. That number should also be higher, but I'm glad it's at least that
high.
Well,
I mean, he only has a 46% approval rating. His numbers are underwater because he has a 51% disapproval rating right now.
Right.
So his numbers have steadied, but they're just back to what they were before the pandemic, which was right during the impeachment trial and or in the impeachment hearings. And I think one thing that's important to note is that usually in a crisis, your approval rating skyrockets. George Bush had 90% approval rating after 9/11. We talked about that last week. George Bush, who we now think of as, if you're paying attention to history, one of the more evil presidents that we've had.
Right. Probably the second worst president.
The second worst president. That third, Nixon was pretty bad.
Yeah, that's true.
He did start the EPA. But so we're sort of, it's not surprising, but it is also surprising that Trump boost barely lasted like a week.
Yeah, lasted like a week or two.
And it was never that high. Yeah. It was, his boost got him above 50, but that was about it. And then they also polled where people trust the information that they're getting, or where people trust to get their information from.
Yeah.
70% or 69% said the CDC. Right. 66% said their state's governor. In this situation, mm-hmm. that's the best we can hope for. 60% said Dr. Fauci.
Yep.
46% said Andrew Cuomo. He's the only governor on this list, but he is, I guess, the most high profile.
Yep.
Then 36% trust Trump. 35% Yikes. Trust Pence, which is funny because Pence has said so much less and lied so many fewer times. And 26% trust Biden.
Yikes, guys.
Now, Biden is also less distrusted. So when they polled whether people distrusted these players, 52% said they distrusted Trump.
Which is a huge number.
Which is a majority of people polled. 37% said they distrusted Pence, and only 29% said that they distrusted Biden.
Right.
But why is he trusted or distrusted at all?
Well, that's the thing.
I mean, like, trusted, but distrusted?
I mean, I think this is the story of Joe Biden, right? He's not trusted. He's not distrusted. He's not well-liked. He's not vehemently hated.
He's
not
just a guy.
Exciting. He's not the most boring person that's ever lived. He sort of is, like, I feel like these numbers speak to his, like, general blandness.
Well, like, also to me, they speak to his general absence, because if coronating yourself the Democratic contender for president and you're in the middle of a huge crisis, you would want the sense of from people that you are somebody who can be trusted to lead in a crisis like this and therefore trusted with information about the crisis.
Yeah, well, here we
are. But the problem is he doesn't often know what he's saying, so you actually can't trust him, not because you think he's nefarious even, but just because
he's talking in gibberish.
Meanwhile, we've decided to face our biggest problem head on and just go ahead and cut our funding to the WHO.
Right? I mean,
the only
just
organization keeping anything together in the entire world right now, which is, oh, by the way, the WHO doesn't just work on coronavirus. They work on a lot of global health issues and are incredibly important.
Well,
but
he also keeps having this insane talking point about like how they aren't doing enough or whatever, or like weren't out in front of this. It's like they told you in January that this was a big fucking deal.
Couldn't have been more in front of it. They were as in front as people were able to be with an emerging virus.
Yeah. And we're cutting off a huge portion of their budget too, because like we're the biggest funders. We give them more than $400 million a year and their annual budget is $4.8 billion. So that's a huge chunk of change in the middle of a pandemic to be, you know, pulling from them. Well, just doesn't make any sense.
Maybe we can start a secondary pandemic now.
Oh.
Maybe polio can come back because they won't have the money to give people polio vaccines. I mean, we have measles could come back. I mean, we have so many fun diseases that are only stamped out in, you know, really vulnerable parts of the world because of organizations like the WHO that give people free vaccines. So let's go wild, you know?
Sure.
Maybe we can have a double pandemic.
Oh, God. Well, if we listen to the doctors that are on Fox News, that might just be what happens.
Well, and it might not matter. What's losing a few people?
Well, yeah, exactly. Fox News has been having on all of the fake doctors, and they're the doctors that have heard of before. It's Dr. Oz, Dr. Drew, Dr. Phil.
Dr. Phil. Dr. Phil, by the way, not a licensed anything in any state, just FYI.
Well, certainly not in science, which is it seems like he's speaking.
He's licensed in television hosting.
He's licensed in television hosting.
But he's not actually a doctor, is what I'm saying.
By the way, thank you, Oprah, for both of these people.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway, they've had a rough go of it this week because, like, Fox News is treating them like they're experts, and they're not, and so they're saying insane things. And they need to get off of our television and pretending like they know things about the coronavirus. The word doctor is not followed by either Fauci or Birx, then don't turn off the television.
That's right.
You're Dr. not listening Oz to the also right doctors.
Managed to phrase his comment in the most bizarre way. So that it also sounds like he's pro eating school children.
I know. He said schools. Oh, go ahead.
Schools are a very appetizing opportunity. I just saw a nice piece in The Lancet arguing that opening schools may only cost us 2-3% in terms of total mortality. What's losing a few people when you can eat school children?
What's losing 3% of the population if we could just send our children back to
an
school?
An appetizing opportunity? Like, schools are a restaurant dish? Like, so gross. That whole quote is so weird and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And then Dr. Phil wanted to remind us that people die of other things, so why bother with this?
Right. He said, the fact of the matter is we have 45,000 people a year die from automobile accidents, 480,000 people from cigarettes, 360,000 people from swimming pools, and we don't shut down the country. Or we don't shut the country down for that, and yet we are doing it for this. And the fallout is going to last for years because people's lives are going to be destroyed.
One thing that we do for some of those is have huge multi-million-dollar campaigns to improve the safety outcomes. We require people to buy car insurance. We've had huge anti-smoking campaigns that have cost probably billions of dollars over the last 10 years, 20 years. We require extensive pool regulation and training for people to protect people from dying in swimming pools because we lose people in swimming pools. And these are probably deaths that occur in private swimming pools, but public swimming pools are heavily regulated because of that. These are all things that we have taken preventative action towards.
Yeah. And they're also all things that are not contagious.
That's right.
A swimming pool. You can't catch swimming pool from going outside.
A swimming pool also can't catch you. You can be in a swimming pool because you are in a swimming pool and nothing is happening around you that would endanger anyone else.
Also, it wouldn't surprise me to learn a year from now that the number of swimming pool deaths
is much lower than this.
This year.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, because everybody's at home. Stuck at home.
Swimming in their pools.
That's so true. Well, then we should just cancel the stay-at-home order, Brent. If people are going to die in their swimming pools, then why do it?
Right. We'll lose them to coronavirus, but we'll save them from swimming pool.
That's right. Exactly. So instead of losing them in a way that doesn't burden our healthcare system, we'll lose them in the most burdensome possible way so that everyone else can die of heart attack.
We should just have like a mass drowning. That's what we should do.
2-3%, and then we just get it out of the way, and an appetizing opportunity opens up to us.
Oh, God. Also, Dr. Drew had to apologize because on his podcast, he was talking about how, like, this is basically the same thing as the flu. And he'd said it on a bunch of different – I mean, he was rolling with it. That wasn't a slip of the tongue.
It wasn't an accident.
That was the story that he was just going with.
Yeah. Meanwhile, this misinformation is really – it's having an impact.
Yeah.
One impact is that people are protesting. And this is interesting because it's rare that the far right are the only people who are not too scared to protest. Like, right now, we have all of these far right protests happening all over the country. And, like, everyone else is trying to be a good person. So they're not showing up in a crowd places.
Right.
So there's no way to have a counter protest because you can't have a stay at home counter protest without leaving home.
Right.
So instead, we have gun-toting Trump supporters showing up at state capitals, threatening violent insurrection, and we have Trump encouraging that by tweeting a series of liberate tweets for various states, including Michigan, Minnesota, and Virginia, where he also encouraged them to save their great Second Amendment.
Right. Only swing states, too, by the way. I mean, he didn't care about liberating Utah.
He didn't care about liberating California, and California had a protest this week.
Yeah.
Huntington Beach. Yeah. An odd number of the people at the protest were wearing face masks, which made me think it was mostly onlookers.
Oh, yeah, it could have been.
I feel like you don't go to a protest where you're arguing that coronavirus is a hoax in a face mask if you truly believe it's a hoax.
Yeah. But there were we saw obviously a lot of Trump signs, a lot of MAGA hats, a lot of Confederate flags in non-Confederate states.
Mm-hmm.
We saw Alex Jones was at the one in Texas, by the way.
Right.
Who said that the virus was a, quote, shy, calm, globalist bioweapons attack, referring to Chinese Communist Party there. And then said, America knows it's a hoax.
Well, and this is the talk that I'm talking about when
like
I say
Sandy
that slowly
Hook.
Some of these people are going to This is not like Sandy Hook, because Sandy Hook was actually a contained event that happened in one place.
No, I'm talking, I know, he said that was a hoax, but I'm saying,
of the things he normally says is a hoax.
Oh, right.
This is one that's going to come for these people. They're right. going to know someone who dies of coronavirus, and that is making, that's going to make it harder. Right. I mean, that's from going to these protests. That's going to make it harder to keep up the momentum. I mean, I understand people are hurting economically and they don't know what to do, but that's going to make it hard to hold, to keep this momentum going if every time that you show up at a coronavirus protest, one of your fellow protesters dies of coronavirus. But Trump's been toying with the idea of holding rallies in defiance of the laws.
Oh, yeah. They're going to have, like, what is it? Like, no fear rallies or something? No fear rallies. Like that or something?
So, yeah. And also, Stephen Moore is encouraging a drive-in protest in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
He's on the council to reopen the country. Mm-hmm. And he's planning to help. He said in a video posted on a libertarian think tank's YouTube page earlier this week, they're going to shut down the Capitol. Shh, don't tell anybody.
Uh-huh. And then
we
said,
we need to be the Rosa Parks here and protest against these government injustices.
Yeah,
just like Rosa Parks.
Rosa Parks. Ooh, yikes.
But don't worry, if we stay in quarantine long enough, we're going to have some good reading, because Michael Cohen is writing a tell-all.
Right.
First note, you and Michael Cohen are currently living the same life.
You're in the same prison right now.
That's right. Because Michael Cohen was allowed to leave prison because of the pandemic and is now serving out his sentence at home. So just like all of us, Michael Cohen is just...
Yeah, he was supposed to be in for at least another year. I think it was like November 2021, I think. So, but don't worry. He's been keeping in touch with Tom Arnold. So Tom Arnold has all the Michael Cohen information for prison.
Right.
Tom Arnold said this week, he said, it's like Jaws. You don't see Jaws very much, but you hear the music. And for Trump, he knows Michael Cohen is coming, and Trump better hear the Jaws music.
Yeah.
I love that. You don't see Jaws very much is like a thing that sounds like a Trump quote, actually.
I know.
You know, you don't see Jaws very much.
Tom Arnold
is not out there a lot.
He's sort of like an early version of a Donald Trump. Like he's like an early prototype.
Yeah, they're like a similar blowhard.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But so Michael Cohen, get ready. Book on the shelves. He wants it out before the election. So
yeah, we better
good reading get coming to work. Our way.
Yeah.
That's right. So that's the news this week. Hopefully next week I will spend the week in less rage and more, you know, carbohydrate related bliss or something.
You know what? Just like lean into it.
I mean, I leaned in this week.
Well, you did. I know.
This week, I leaned harder than I've ever leaned in.
I know.
So if you're thinking that you don't understand what all this is about, I've just now told you, and now you know a person who's being, quote unquote, unreasonable. So just deal with yourself. And we will be back next week with more fun quarantine podcast. Bye.